There is a one or two line passage in the Talmud that makes Purim interesting for most people. And the truth is, this is probably what motivates more people, at least over here. Some of you I consider to be great tzaddikim, because, you know, think about it. Purim is only a rabbinic law, and I'm sorry I put the word only over there, because I know some people get upset with this when you say only. Purim is a rabbinic law. And of the rabbinic laws on Purim, there's a couple things we do. We read the Megillah, we have a Sudan, we give gifts, and so on, take care of the poor. And there's one little thing in it, which is drinking. And if you think about it, you know, there are people in this room who have been preparing for this the entire year in order to be able to fulfill this mitzvah in the proper way. So as I said, I have a great deal of respect that people have so much kavod for rabbinic laws. And I'm just saying, just think about it, because some people say, oh, that's a Torah, it's a rabbinic law, I don't like rabbinic laws. You love rabbinic laws. You love Hanukkah, you love Purim, you love rabbinic laws. That's really what it comes down to. So, having observed that, what I want to look at for the moment, just to start off, is the passage in the Gemara which talks about drinking on Purim. Because at face value, it's strange, and my first thought, which is really why I'll explain the first thought, or we moved away what I was going to do today, was going to spend the whole time on this passage. And I'll tell you what's interesting about it, and then why we're not going to do it. The passage itself talks about the quote-unquote obligation to drink on Purim. Let's read it. Amar Rava. Rava said, Michayev inish levsume, a person is obligated, and I just want to point out over here, the phrase is in Aramaic, so it doesn't say, and this is going to depend a little bit on interpretation, and maybe why this particular word is used, it didn't say the Hebrew, chayav adam, and now my third word could be one of two words, it could either have been lishtot, to drink, by the way, it also could have been, and this will sound very strange to you, likadesh, to make kiddush. I mean, think about it. Here's the first rabbinic holiday. We don't know what a rabbinic holiday is. The only rabbinic holidays that we're familiar with prior to this is possibly 2 days of Yom Tov, which means somebody's far away from Israel. They don't know exactly when the new year is. They may have to keep a second day. Second day Yom Tov is a rabbinic law, and yet it's treated identically to the Torah day. You can't do any work. You can't do any melacha. You make kiddush. You do everything identical to being a regular Torah holiday. So the fact that they created a rabbinic holiday, which is different, is itself essentially uncharted territory. Now, what is it? So I could have argued, you know what? Even though we're allowed to do melacha, think about the word kiddush. What does the word kiddush mean? It means to make holy. So maybe you only make something holy when you're not allowed to do melacha. So what I'm saying is that this idea of Purim, which we have no idea what a rabbinic holiday should be, and there is an undertone in the Talmud that maybe they actually wanted to make it into a real Yom Tov. You can already get that from the language of Megillat Esther itself, but maybe that's what they wanted. Let's make this into a holiday. What kind of holiday? So I'm saying that answer, what kind of holiday, is not clear. So maybe there's an argument, let's make Kiddush. Now Kiddush doesn't work, because Kiddush, holy, only works when you have a holy day, which I would say right now should go together with a lack of melacha. So when I go back to this passage, a person is obligated, m'chayv inish livsume, so there is a concept of simcha. Okay, so let's pause a second. What does the word simcha translate? Happiness. Shabbat is not a day of happiness. This Oneg Shabbat, to enjoy Shabbat, but it's not a day of happiness. Happiness normally goes with the holidays. And by the holidays we say, Ein Simcha Ela Basar B'Yayin, that happiness is expressed by eating meat and by drinking wine. Incidentally, you don't like meat, you don't like wine, and you to force yourself to do it is certainly not happiness. So if somebody's a vegetarian, nobody could hold out, you know, the Gemara, the Rambam, and say, hold it, you have to eat this because this is what makes you happy, when you're saying, no, this makes me sick, this doesn't make me happy. But therefore the rabbis would say, no, generally, this is how somebody gets happy. And the real reason for this is that our meals somehow echo what took place in the Beit HaMikdash when they brought a korban, and that would have been meat, and which was eaten afterwards, and it was also done with wine libation, so therefore there is wine and meat involved in the original type of simcha, original type of happiness, which leads us back to our problem. What's the problem? We don't know what this holiday of Purim is. So here, we have a statement. Now again, let me point out, Amar Rava, when does Rava live? So you have no idea, right? So Rava is an Amora, which means we're not talking about a Mishnah, we're talking about actually a third generation, right? Babylon, 3 years, 300 or so. Amar Rava, he says, Mechayev inish levsume bepuria. A person is obligated, now I'm going to say it again, that word levsume is difficult. Didn't mean something like, okay, make kiddush, have some wine. Doesn't mean drink, which maybe is a little bit stronger. Doesn't mean get drunk. Should the Hebrew here be lishtot, lekadesh, lishtok, or lehishtaker, to become drunk? All of those I'm willing to say as a possibility right now. Mechayev inish levsume bepuria. But the word levsume is such an interesting word. And yes, it's Aramaic. And yes, to do this really seriously, we would have to check all over Talmud and wherever Aramaic literature is used to know how this word levsume is used. What's interesting for us, at least, is it may or may not mean intoxicated. It may mean to feel good. It may mean to become chilled. It may mean to relax. It could be to become of good spirit. All of that could be the word. But what's interesting in levsume is there is something close also to smell, besamim. There is this idea of smell involved in this, which is a theme which we saw last week. So let's hold off on that. But everything I just now said regarding the possible definition of the word levsume bepuria is meaningless in light of the continuation of the sentence. The rest of the sentence says, and I'll go from the beginning, Amar Rava, Rava says, Mechayev inish levsume, a person's obligated to drink bepuria on Purim, which is Aramaic for Purim, ad delo yada, until they don't know, bein baruch Mordechai la'or Haman, till they don't know the difference between Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed. Now, that's the statement. And my problem with this statement is that that's not very simple. Now, I said in the beginning, and you thought I was kidding, that the drinking that you've done all year has been preparing for Purim. Not only preparing for Purim, the drinking you've done all year is going to help us understand the halacha. How so? By the way, this is right now a magical process, because now you're taking your knowledge in order to teach Torah, right? And if you didn't drink, you wouldn't know this. So, what happens when you have that first drink? Nothing. Oh, here's it. Okay, she's hardcore. Okay. Everybody agree with that? Nothing?
Yeah, one drink.
One drink?
You get a little tipsy.
By the way, ever since, I know you're about to lose respect for me, ever since my kids started to drive, I won't drive if I had even one drink. Because I tell them not to, so I will not do it. Even if I say, I feel fine, I'm okay, it's just one drink. Right? So right. So if I'm going to drive, if I had anything, I won't drive. So one drink, everybody agrees nothing, or anybody a little something. Yeah. So you have one drink. What happens? Two drinks. You know what? I'm not being fair. There's nobody to. Good. There's nobody to define what a drink is. How much have you eaten before? Are you an empty stomach? I mean, how much you weigh? 4 or 5? Where are you up? Have you ever seen so much participation? It is. If somebody has one drink, tell me when you really disagree. Somebody has one drink, maybe nothing, maybe just a little, 2, 3 drinks, and now maybe you're starting to feel good. 4 or 5 drinks?
Yeah.
Okay, nice drunk. If you want to go a little bit further, 7, 8, meaning you could get to the point that you're going to do things that you wouldn't do if you weren't drunk, which is really where a lot of people want to get to, because they don't have to feel bad about what they did because it wasn't them, because they were drunk and everything, and life is good. You like that phase, okay. So do a lot of guys, but okay. My problem is, when you get to that point, it's not good drunk. Good. Now, where do you get after that? You normally get after that to on your knees, worshiping, what do they call this? The porcelain god.
Or in an alley.
And if you keep going from that point, there's a good chance you will A, pass out, B, pass out and not wake up. Which means you get to alcohol poisoning. It's very cool. Can I explain to you my problem? I don't understand the Gemara. The Gemara said you're obligated to drink to the point that you don't know the difference between that Haman should be cursed and Mordechai should be blessed. I don't see how you ever get to that point. Have you ever met somebody who's drunk so much that said, hold it a second, was Hitler the good guy or was that Mother Teresa? I mean, I am being so serious about this. I don't understand the Gemara, because how functionally are we supposed to get to that point? And by the way, if the mitzvah is to get to that point, if you start to feel better, you're supposed to get to that point again? You know, you have to keep getting to the point you don't know anything, but you don't know anything, how do you know that you're not? Anyway, I'm just saying, I don't understand. Yeah, but how, you never get to this point. Okay, by the way, do you ever confuse basic good and evil? So I'm saying, that's what, now, next line in the Gemara, and by the way, the next line is an Agadah. The next line says, Rabba v'Rabbi Zeira, two rabbis, also lived in Babel. Rabbi Zeira is a little more interesting because he lived in Babel, and then he ran away from Babel, moved to the land of Israel. Maybe this was why. Okay, you ready? Rabba and Rabbi Zeira, avdu sudat purim bahadei hadadi. They had their Purim Suda together. Bata de Ipsam, when they got intoxicated, which now I translated as Besume is intoxicated, Kum Rabba, Rabba stood up, pulled a knife, Vishachte, which literally means performed Shechita, he ritually slaughtered L'Rebbe Zeira. He ritually slaughtered Rebbe Zeira. L'machar, the next day, Boy Rachmele, V'achaye. He prayed for him, and he brought him back to life. Lashana, the next year, Amorle, he said, you know, that was so cool, you know. Amorle, Leite mar v'na'avid sudat purim b'hadi adadi, let's do Purim together. Amorle, he answered him, Lav kol sha'ata v'sha'ata mitcharesh nisa. Miracles don't happen every day. Thank you, but no thank you. I'm going someplace else for Purim. This story about Rabba and Rabbi Zeira getting drunk and Rabba killing Rabbi Zeira comes in the Gemara right after. You're obligated to drink the point that you don't know difference in good and evil. And Rabba got up and killed. Now, what does the Agadah do with Halacha? So as I said, I have a whole nother topic, and that would be trying to understand the interrelationship generally between Halacha and Agadah. To what extent from Agadah do you learn Halacha? To what extent are these two separate realms? Why was this story brought over here? Some Rishonim just say straight up, based on this story, the teaching of Rava that you have to get drunk on Purim has now been permanently, absolutely rejected. And because of the story of Rabbi Zeira, there is no obligation to drink on Purim. That, a whole bunch of Rishonim understand that's the conclusion. But by the way, there is a whole continuation in terms of the Shechita and the two of them. But going back to your point, there was somebody in the Rabbi Ephraim Margoliot, who wrote a commentary called the Yad Ephraim, which whoever printed the Shulchan Aruch had a sense of humor, and sometimes to know which commentary you're going to, there's a big Aleph, a little Aleph, a Rashi with it. So to get to his commentary, there's a Yad, there's a hand, and that leads to the commentary called the Yad Ephraim. And the Yad Ephraim says that he was very troubled by this, and in a dream, it came to him that Ad means Ad v'lo Ad b'chlal. Chayev Adish l'fsumri b'pur ya Ad d'lo yada. You have to get... Right. Meaning if you've gone that far, you've gone too far. The Yad Ephraim says this, Ephraim Margoliot. If you've gone this far, you've gone too far. And what's the proof? That's exactly what it says. Oh, look what happens when you go too far. So therefore, it confirms that, therefore he read it, it confirms there is an obligation to drink, but don't drink too much, which would be exactly the point. Beautiful. A first question is, before you get to the bottom line, is just understanding the source. So over here, we have a source that says you're obligated to drink. You have another source that says, look what happens when you drink. And as I said, I am very intrigued what all this means, what they want from us. Yes, in terms of later commentaries, if you want, I can give you 90-second advertisement on what it says in the various commentaries. Some say, based upon the Rishonim, there used to be a song. And the refrain of the song half the time was Baruch Mordechai, and half the time was Orer Haman, and therefore you had to get drunk to the point you get confused which... You sing. Tosfot likes that interpretation. So how drunk do you have to get that you don't know exactly which refrain to use? Not all that much. So he just now took it from not knowing the difference between good and evil to not knowing which... So then there's another interpretation that I'm going to be showing him that say that you need to drink enough to realize that Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai both equal to 502, which means there really is no difference, which actually could be either an answer or a very... deep point. The Rambam seems to imply till you fall asleep. The Rambam says that black and white. that once you're sleeping, you don't know the difference. As I said, you have lots and lots of commentaries trying to figure out how to make sense out of all this. But fundamentally, face value, I don't think we can make sense of all this, unless, of course, there's something which is a lot deeper over here. There is a commentary which is found by the Taz, who, by the way, the Taz is, his name was Rav David Halevi. He is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. He tries to explain what it means to drink, and at the end of the day, he pretty much tries to reject it. Source number 4, he does write, "You need to thank God for the good things that happened to the Jews." That's Baruch Mordechai. "And you need to thank God for Arur Haman, for the bad that he did to our enemies." And he tries to say that the whole idea of Purim is that you need to really try to work out which is the more important element. Is it that God rewards the good, or is it that God punishes the bad? Which, by the way, just now turned this into a very philosophical position. Later on in his commentary, he ends up saying, but because Rabbah killed Reb Zera, we don't follow all this anyway. The Vilna Gaon does follow the Taz on this, and he says that's the idea. On Purim, you drink, and then you contemplate God's wonders. You contemplate the good that God does for us and the bad he does to our enemies, and then you try to figure out, you know, what really is the difference between the two, or what really is the whole idea. But which, as I said, turns it into a very philosophical thing and sort of ruined the drinking for at least some people. Now, what I want to do is I want to move back. I'm going to see if we can work this out together. One thing which is interesting about this, and you don't know yet why it's really interesting, but one thing which is interesting about this is that it creates a duality. Do you see the duality? Between Haman should be cursed and Mordechai should be blessed. There's a duality between, and now you can choose, Esther and Vashti, like we discussed last time, or 2 times ago, or is there maybe a duality even between Esther and Zeresh? There's a duality, meaning there seems to be these people playing off of each other. Now, how about this little piece of what I think is interesting information? The kingdom in Persia was not a kingdom which was idolatrous per se, which means you go through the whole story, there's not one word about idolatry in it. You go through other sources around the same time. Again, remember, the first temple is destroyed not that far before this. One of the reasons destroyed because of idolatry. There's no idolatry over here. Yeah, people are partying, people are doing bad things, but there's no idolatry per se. That itself is interesting. In Persia, they did not believe in idols and avodah zarah, but they did believe in dualism. They did believe in a good or a bad God. So therefore, this dualistic background to the story over here as well, it's, as I said, also becomes interesting that we want to thank God for, one God, for either the good things that happened to Mordechai or the bad things that happened to Haman. So we're taking the duality and then we're sort of taking it all the way back. Everything goes back to God. So as I said, that's one thing that we should know as we go into it. But now I want to go back to what we touched last time at the end, and I told you that there are so many different interpretations of this, and I want to try to work this through with you, and then we'll see hopefully how this may be related as well. And that is this idea, which, as I said, we saw in context. What was it? That there's some kind of a connection between Yom Kippur and Purim. What did we see was the connection? What did we suggest last time based upon the actual source? That Esther really is like a Kohen Gadol. Esther really is the one who brings about forgiveness to the entire Jewish people. Esther is the one who goes in to see the king and brings about forgiveness. Now again, think about another point, and this is something that I once mentioned in passing. The Bible itself as a book, I think, is an interesting book. I think it's contemporary in terms of human needs and human behavior, human actions, ego, and so on. There's 2 elements of it which are completely foreign to us. One element is man's need to worship idols, and the second element is prophecy, and therefore miracles that go with this. You take away the prophetic and the miraculous, and you take away the idolatrous, and you're basically left with contemporary society. According to the Vilna Gaon, the two of them, the absence of idolatry and the absence of prophecy, happen at the same time, and that's really what the beginning of the Second Temple. So right now we're really at the very end of prophecy, even though it does not exist over here in the story. Here's a story which without any prophecy, but it's interesting to me then at least that not only is there no prophecy in the story, the other side is also missing, namely, what else is missing? Also idolatry. And therefore, we have a whole different type of thing. Can you imagine now the Jews who were invited to the party of Achashverosh, their inner discussions and rationalizations of why it's really okay to go to the party. What would be the best reason it's really okay anyway? It's not an idolatrous party. It's not like they're worshipping Avodah Zarah. It's not like there's something only bad going on over here. Okay, it's not a holy party. It's basically Pariv. We're just going to it. We're just going to go and have a good time. There's nothing bad about this. One second. Do you like that mindset? Especially coming after destruction of the first temple, which was connected to idolatry. Here there's no idolatry. So what's so bad about participating in the party itself? Okay, so I'm just leaving that as what I think is an interesting starting point. But let's go back again. We have Purim Yom Kippur, face value, no connection whatsoever, other than this little linguistic coincidence. Okay? Full stop. Not only is the linguistic coincidence unconvincing, they come from two different roots. What does Kippur, what is the root of the word Kippur, Kippurim? The root is atonement, lechaper. What is the root of Purim, of Pur? It comes from a foreign word, and the foreign word meaning lots. So lots and atonement, this has nothing to do with one another, right? Yes or no, right?
Yes.
Wrong. And that's where it starts to get interesting. Because if you notice, like there is this minor issue, which is actually very funny why they called it the holiday of Purim. Why did they call it Purim? Because Haman drew lots. Haman drew lots in order to choose a day to kill the Jews. Which day does he end up with? He ends up in Adar, which, by the way, actually gave us a little bit of time because it was 11 months from when he chose it. Right? He actually did this. The story, the events of the story of Purim, the major events took place on Pesach. He has 11 months until the Jews are going to be killed. That's where he drew the lots. Now, let's go back a second. Do lots have anything whatsoever to do with Yom Kippur? On Yom Kippur, do you remember there are two goats, and one is La Hashem. The other, by the way, you all know how you say it in English. You just don't know, may know that it's a Torah thing. What is it called? A scapegoat. Sir La Hashem and Sir La Azazel. You have two goats. You bring them both to the temple. You draw lots of the two of them. One of them will be used to forgive the people inside, and the other one is called the Sir La Azazel. It's taken outside of the temple, and it's done away with. It's called, right, it's a lot. Which one is La Hashem and which one is La Azazel? And you know what's real interesting about that? I just now have this, I don't want to call it dualism, but I just have this duality where God and this other thing are right here in front of us. So, even though I started off saying that Yom Kippur and Purim have nothing to do with one another, and one is based upon the root of tone, another is based upon lots, and lots have nothing to do with Yom Kippur except that they do, so that's where things, as I said, do get a little bit more interesting. Not only that, the two animals that we use, the Mishnah says about them, they need to look as identical as possible. What does the Mishnah say they need to look like? Go ahead, tell me. And therefore like? Like twins. Excellent. I was waiting all year to ask you that. According to the Mishnah, they're supposed to be the same in every way that you look at them. It's not like, oh, this is the nicer one, this is an ugly one, this is heavy, this is not heavy. No, they're supposed to look exactly the same. So visually what we get from that is twins. Can I ask you a really bad question? In Judaism, do we ever have twins that become something interesting?
Yeah.
Esav and Yaakov are twins. Esav and Yaakov being twins, and by the way, you can never confuse them, because that never happens and people get confused between the two of them, unless maybe somebody did once. The two of them later on become, Yaakov becomes Yisrael, and Esav ends up morphing into Amalek. Which means now we go all these years later, and we have these, okay, we have Mordechai and Haman, as a later generation, and by the way, we say, hold it, how could anybody ever confuse? I'm not saying they're twins, I'm just asking, I'm just saying, how can anybody ever possibly confuse Haman and Mordechai? So I'm pointing out that the two of them come from a source of Yaakov and Esav, which are actually twins. So therefore, again, what I just now did, I think was very, very simple. I actually think was elegant, but it's not nice if I say that about myself. But what I actually did is I try to show you that the Purim goes back to the Goral, which is how it's called, the two lots. The lots are for the two different goats. The two different goats represent Yaakov and Esav. What's Esav's other name? Seir. What, how do you say goat in Hebrew? Se'ir. So therefore, to say that the Se'ir la'azazel is somehow connected to Esav, of course that's connected to Esav. But they're supposed to be twins. Where do we ever find twins? Well, we find twins when we look at Yaakov and Esav are, in fact, twins. So I just said that's interesting. By the way, who did get confused between the two of them? Yitzchak. So Yitzchak there was the first one to ever celebrate Purim, the first one ever to get to the point of Ad lo yada bein Yaakov and Esav. And by the way, why did he get confused? He got confused because Yaakov dressed up. Which again, I'm going to insist that the whole dressing up goes right back to that point. Yaakov and Esav, who have this, basically this war between them. As far as we're concerned, one is good and one is bad. Try one more time. Because Yaakov dresses up as Esav, he ends up taking the blessing which was designed for Esav, which is a blessing for all for this world. Many years later, Esav is going to catch up with him and want to kill him. He already says it right then. So therefore, if I want to ask, so where does all of the anti-Semitism come from? It comes from that one point, which ironically is from our own brother. Haman is described as being Haman from Agag. Agag comes from Amalek. Amalek comes from Esav. Which means that as far-fetched as all this sounded when I began, so I said, let's look at Purim, let's look at Yom Kippur, and let's look if there's anything which may possibly be related between these two different days. So I'm pointing out that the whole starting point, I didn't even get to the starting point yet, that Yom Kippur also has within it these lots. The lots are among the two goats, Seir, two goats. One is for God, one is sent away. The parallel to that is the twins, which are Yaakov and Esav, right? One ends up being for God and gets Berachat Avraham, and the other ends up being sent away and going to Seir, going off. And I'm saying this is like exact words, everything I'm saying now, exact words what it says in Bereishit. The other thing which is interesting is that you have Yaakov and his children all bowing down to Esav, and we have a lot of bowing down going here as well. By the way, where's the other place that we have bowing down? In the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol says LaHashem, when he says the name of God, there's also bowing down. So you're bowing down LaHashem and bowing down for this other side for Haman, which also creates a type of duality. But now for the first time, I pointed out a duality running through from Yom Kippur to Purim, one time LaHashem and one time Mamash LaAzazel, which is the way I'm describing Haman right now. So what I'm saying then is that the first time that anybody ever got confused between Yaakov and Esav was Yitzchak. You're right. By the way, say he was drunk also. Say, you can say whatever you want. He was drinking, he was eating, say whatever you want. I'm just saying, where's the first time you find confusion between Yaakov and Esav? You find it by Yitzchak, who maybe could have or should have known better. Yes, there's a great excuse. He's blind. But as I said, that itself is interesting. A matter of fact, the meal that he brings him in to feed him, Chazal there say that because of this meal that he brings him, that's why we ended up having Yom Kippur afterwards. The same kind, it actually says it. Okay, and it also suggests maybe there's a connection with Pesach, but I don't have time to do that, except for the fact that Purim comes out on Pesach, but as I said, really, really, that would be going too far astray. Now, coming back to our lots, and one more question, where does Yom Kippur begin? How does the Yom Kippur begin? Where did it come from? Who made up this decision that we have to have Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur, good. Okay, Matan Torah, that's real interesting. Because the day the Jews finally accept the Torah, God tried to give us the Torah, right? We get to Har Sinai, he tries to give us the Torah. When Moshe comes down from the mountain with Luchot, what's going on? They're making a party. One second. They're making a party. The party is called the party of the golden calf. The beginning of Yom Kippur is the party of the golden calf, where they eat and they drink and they do all kinds of sins. The beginning of the Purim story is the party. The sin of the golden calf is absolutely parallel to the party that takes place in the middle. What then ends up happening? Moshe goes and prays for the people, and then God forgives us that first year in Yom Kippur. And then what does he say to us subsequently? That every year from now on, we're going to have Yom Kippur, a day that you'll be forgiven. You don't eat, you don't drink, you don't engage in sexual behavior and so on, which means all the sins you did by the golden calf you don't do. On the other hand, the Purim story begins also with a party. So I'm just now again pointing out that I have two parties over here, although it's interesting. Because Yom Kippur, what does it then become? It becomes then a day that you don't eat, and how does the Purim holiday then come to a day that you do eat? Which means food is a part of this, food and drink is a part of this, The difference between a su'udah and a mishteh is a su'udah is where you eat and a mishteh is where you drink. There is this mishteh that they have in the beginning. Over here, then I'm saying again, Yom Kippur begins with the golden calf. The holiday of Purim begins with the party that takes place in the beginning. At the end, we have a day that you eat. At the end, by Yom Kippur, every day that you fast. Although, just to get the irony a little bit better, the day before Yom Kippur is a day that you're obligated to eat. The day before Purim is a day that you're obligated to fast. So you have 2 days versus 2 days. Eat, fast, fast, eat. Where it's not just a thing. You're obligated to fast the day before Purim, and you're obligated to eat the day before Yom Kippur, which just again means that this parallel is, as I said, I think a little bit more interesting. The other thing about a goral, a lot, is that I leave things to chance. I leave things to chance. The idea of seeing a world through chance is actually totally involved in the whole. What we perceive to be the Amalek worldview, it says that Asher Karcha Bederech, they happened upon you along the way. Mikre, Lashon Mikre, that's what Rashi says. It was a coincidence, they just happened to be there. People also point out that Amalek in Gematria is 240, it's also Safek, that we have doubts, you don't know, it's a lack of clarity. It's actually very interesting to me, is that we have, in order to separate this lack of clarity, what do? We drink, and therefore we obtain a lack of clarity, which seems to me to be really, really quite strange. The other thing that I'm going to throw into this whole mix, because I do think that there's one more element to this, and this is also that we touched last time. Haman, when the Gemara asked, how do we know there's a man like Haman, what answer does it say? Hamin ha'etz, the one who's from the tree. Which tree? The tree of knowledge and good and evil. What happens when you eat from a tree of knowledge of good and evil? You get confused between good and evil. What happens when you get confused between good and evil? You don't know, Bain, or Haman, the Varech Mordechai. Which means this point of confusion goes all the way back to the first point of confusion. So I essentially have a point of confusion in the Garden of Eden. I have a point of confusion at the foot of Mount Sinai where they're worshipping the golden calf instead of waiting for Moshe to come down. I have a point of confusion in the beginning of the Purim story where what are they all doing? They're all going to this party. Well, maybe there's no idolatry. Well, maybe yes, but they're in the wrong party. They're in the wrong place where you shouldn't necessarily be celebrating there. Yom Kippur becomes the day that we get forgiven for our inappropriate behavior. But I want you to pay attention, because this is actually an answer, like a pause. We're actually going to say something which I think is an answer, and not just to get to the next point. But when I look at Yom Kippur and Purim together, and I go all the way back to the Garden of Eden for that matter, there is this common denominator of basically eating what I should not be eating, or when I should not be eating it. God says eat from every single tree, except for this tree, so which tree do we want? We want the one tree we can have. That's human nature, that's how we are. God says you can't have this, that's what we want. So, in a sense, the confusion that came into our lives was by partaking from the tree that we should not have been partaking from. That's where the first problem is introduced. When it comes to the golden calf, we are now worshipping something we should not be worshipping. We're eating and drinking, but the tikkun, that's an important word. How would you say tikkun? The fixing. Now, this is a spiritual fixing that takes place, is therefore Yom Kippur by not eating, by not drinking. And by the way, this is real. When you are about to enter into Yom Kippur, there's a beautiful prayer that if you can get to shul a little bit early, it's worthwhile saying. You say, I've sinned during the year. I've eaten things maybe I shouldn't have eaten. By the way, maybe I shouldn't have eaten could be because it was absolutely not kosher. Maybe it didn't have a good hechsher. Or maybe I just didn't make a bracha with kavanah. Or maybe I ate like a pig. But no matter what, I then say, God, please forgive all the bad eating I've done this year by the fasting that I'm doing right now in Yom Kippur. Let this serve as a tikkun, which means Yom Kippur is a tikkun for the past, tikkun for the bad that I've done. But when I get to Purim, it's a whole different type of tikkun. Because now what am I doing with my eating and drinking and the celebration? What am I doing with it? I'm now going to say, is that this is the way it was supposed to be before I got to the Garden of Eden, before we ate what we shouldn't have eaten from, before we got to confusion, we were supposed to eat because God said to eat, or what God said to eat. We're supposed to drink what God says to drink. Which means Yom Kippur fixes the past, in a sense, and Purim is really sets the stage for the future. I am drinking today because God said to drink. That's very, very different from just going to party. Maybe there's nothing wrong with it. Do you realize what God does for us sometimes? He tells us to do things, and by telling us to do things, he just now turned it into a mitzvah. By telling us to eat and to drink, and by the way, it's not God, it's the rabbis, by telling us now, turn this into a day of eating and drinking, it then becomes a tikkun, but not a tikkun in the negative sense, by stay away from it, But in the positive sense, this is what you should be participating. By the way, is there any other connection between Yom Kippur and Purim? There's actually something else which sort of floats underneath and we ignore. Yom Kippur fixes all sins, right? Wrong. What doesn't it fix? It doesn't fit the interpersonal things, right? Things that ways that we hurt one another. We hurt one another, we have to apologize to one another, we just can't hope, well, you know, this will be okay because I prayed to God. No, you have to forgive one another, and there is this thing that before Yom Kippur you go about trying to say, I'm sorry for what I've done. Is there anything interpersonal about Purim? You give gifts to one another. By the way, same thing. One is, Yom Kippur is I'm fixing what I've done in the past, and on Purim I give gifts to other people, I'm really setting the stage for the future. It's just, it's so similar. But there is a slightly different orientation between the two of them. You know, when I go back to this point about coincidence or leaving things to chance, I mean, that, again, that's what Amalek does. That's what Haman does by using lots. But it's interesting is that we do that in Yom Kippur, and it's interesting to a certain extent is what Haman is doing as well. Maybe I'm going to go like one step further with this, and then we'll see how far we can go. The Maharal from Prague said that there's another thing about Purim and Yom Kippur which seems to make it similar. Yom Kippur, your soul can be in a situation going into Yom Kippur that you've sinned profoundly, and you do not deserve to live anymore. By the way, as bad as that can possibly sound. And then you enter into Yom Kippur, and right here I want to stop, and others say it's just the very holiness of Yom Kippur. It's called the Itzumu Shel Yom. The Yom Kippur itself has this ability to transform us. It's called the Itzumu Shel Yom, the very power of the day. And some claim that Purim has that same element to it. I enter into Yom Kippur, and I've performed a miracle. The miracle that I've performed is that somehow I was able to turn around from death to life. Which means I should die, but because of the prayers and because of the attitude, because of I took things upon myself, God stops, and therefore there is a certain element, and I know Jews don't like to use this word, of resurrection, of coming back from the dead, when we look at Yom Kippur. And I'm saying this element itself is, again, just about to die. And I go back to the whole story of Purim. You have the entire Jews who are about to die, but then something happens and they all are able to come back to life. So this element of coming back to life, I do believe is an essential element of both of these days, but again, they're being done in very differently. But I think having said that, we can now go back to our first story. How so? Rabba and Reb Zeira, they have Purim together. So as I said, there's many, many things that we can say about this. But what happens is this: Rabba gets up and he slaughters Reb Zeira, which means instead of getting the reprieve, instead of Yom Kippur working, instead of Purim working, what ends up happening? That Reb Zeira actually dies. But then what does Rabba somehow do? And don't ask me for details how he does this. But what he does is he somehow brings him back to life. Which means what they then experienced, what Reb Zeira then experienced, is Purim in its most profound aspect. That is what Purim is. It's this whole idea of bringing a people back to life. Again, can we think logically for a second? We just take this for granted, and you shouldn't. What we take for granted is that you could take people out of their country, scatter them all about into a whole bunch of different provinces, right? And somehow we're going to keep our national identity. It makes no sense that we've kept our national identity. It makes no sense that there are any Jews in the world today. Again, think of this absurdity. There are people in this room, and I think that the vast majority of us who are here right now, all of our families come from different places. We all come from completely different places. What kind of absurdity is this that thousands of years after we left our land, we're still going to be able to come back as a people and come back to life? That's completely insane. We first go off into exile when the first temple is destroyed. That should have been the end of the Jewish people. So you know what? And this is really sad. One of the things that keeps us together as a people has been anti-Semitism. I hate to say it, but that's one of the things that has kept us together. Sometimes there are Hamans of the world and Chmelnitskys of the world and Stalins of the world and Hitlers of the world, and we can keep on going, unfortunately, down the line, who have been able to tell us, no, you are one people. And it doesn't make a difference. Jews can be walking, taking a stroll in Turkey, not that I know what they're doing there, and they can be attacked because they're Jews. That's all because they're Jews. We never should have survived the exile to Persia. Never should have gotten that past that point, but we did. And the story of Purim really is not just a resurrection where we're about to die, now we're saved. It's much, much bigger than that. And that's how Jews have celebrated it from generation to generation in this concept of being at the point of death and then coming back to life. But as I said, if you think about it, that is exactly what the experience of Yom Kippur is as well. To go, as I said, just a slight part deeper, when was the first time we came back from exile? It's when Yaakov ran away. Why did Yaakov run away? Because Esav said he's going to kill him. What does Yaakov then do? He sends bribes. He sends gifts to Esav. And apparently they work. That is what the Ramban explains. And it's really based upon a source called the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar. That's what he explains happens every year in Yom Kippur when we send the Seir la'Azazel. God tells us, send this away from the temple. That means that there's such an idea as having an offering outside of the Beit HaMikdash. That's the Seir la'Azazel. You give a gift to Esav, Seir, outside of the Beit HaMikdash. And that is what brings about the forgiveness on Yom Kippur. Over here, in the story of Purim, you also have a bribe taking place, and it's very subtle. Who does the bribe? Well, there's actually two levels of bribe. One level of bribe is all the money that Haman goes and pays off to Ahasuerus. But did you get the other bribe that was really, really subtle? When Esther invites him over and gives him a little food and then, you know, calms him down a little bit? That is, that bribe that takes place right there is actually part of what saves the people. Which means when I started off and I said Yom Kippur and Purim, it sounds almost like a bad joke. It sounds at starting point that these things have nothing to do with one another. And as I said, the roots of the words have nothing to do with one another. But the essence of the days, sometimes they're very, very similar, and sometimes they serve as opposites. So when I start thinking really about what Yom Kippur is, Yom Kippur is a day that we take all of our sins and we send it away to Azazel, we send it away to Esav, we send it away to Azazel, and what is that represented by? Arur Haman. That's giving everything to Esav, to Amalek, to Azazel. On the other hand, what's the other element? The other one? The other one is that we pray that God gives us good things, that God takes care of us, and in a certain sense, that is Baruch Mordechai. Which is, I think this is the deeper level the Gro was saying, so which one is it? If you want to go out now, go all the way back to where I think we began, and that's Yaakov and Esav, and the first time that somebody did get confused enough they didn't know which one was which. What did Yaakov steal from Esav? He stole from him a bracha of Gashmiut, of this worldly things. If you check through Yaakov's life, it doesn't look like he necessarily ever got that blessing fulfilled. You know when we did get it fulfilled? When Mordechai receives all, when he puts on the king's clothing, when he receives Haman's house, when he receives Haman's wealth, suddenly right there we have the bracha of Yitzchak directed towards Esav, now going over to Yaakov. And you know what I think is really significant then? That's why we celebrate the way that we do, primarily in a physical way. Because now is the time that we have finally, it's Baruch Mordechai, it's finally the bracha going that Yaakov got, now it's finally the bracha on the physical, and that's why we eat and we drink and we give gifts to one another, all very, very physical things. There's no lulav and there's no etrog and there's no matzah and there's none of this other spiritual stuff over here. It's very, very physical. On the one hand, physically they wanted to kill us, but on the other hand, it's finally the time that we got to Baruch Mordechai, the bracha that Yaakov was supposed to get all those years ago. So as I said, when I start looking underneath, you know, the outside level, Yom Kippur, Purim, bad joke, nothing to do with one another. When I start to look deeper, well, they both have to do with Lots, and Lots is taking a chance, and a chance is Safek, and Safek has to do with Haman, and that itself is a very non-Jewish way. Well, look what happens. When we started acting in a non-Jewish way, when we start to imitate Esav, you with me? You with me? Why does Yitzchak want to give any of the blessings to Esav? Because he thinks he's very much like Yaakov. Should I say that again? Why did Yitzchak ever want to give the brachot to Esav? Because he thinks that he's very much like Yaakov. He asks him questions, should I give ma'aser from this? Should I do a mitzvah with this? Which means Esav, just as much as we accuse Yaakov, hakol kol Yaakov adayin yei Esav. But think about it a second. Didn't Esav somehow find his Kol Yaakov to try to fool his father? Which means just as much as Yaakov goes in and tries to be like Esav. Esav tries to be like Yaakov, and that's why Yaakov wants to give him a bracha. That's why Yitzchak wants to give him a bracha in the first place. When Esav starts to act like Yaakov, he may be the beneficiary of the brachot. But when Yaakov starts to act like Esav, like we did by the golden calf, like we did when we just decide we can go to the party over there, nothing wrong about it, but we're acting very, very Esav-like, because there's no holiness involved in this. Yaakov is somebody who's supposed to be seeking holiness in what he does. So when Esav acts like Yaakov, he starts to get brachot. When Yaakov acts like Esav, he starts to lose brachot. So we see at the golden calf, and again at the party in the beginning of the story, Yaakov acting like Esav. At the very end, what we need over here is the clarity and the separateness between these two, which means the whole background to the story is the confusion between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. That's what this whole story is really about, but as I said, it really goes through at least three different chapters, starting with Yaakov and Esav, the true Yaakov and Esav, going all the way through B'nai Yisrael and the Erev Rav by the sitting of the golden calf, which is the Yaakov trying to imitate Esav. It goes through then to create Yom Kippur. It goes through to, again, Yaakov trying to be very Esav-like and participating in the party, and it ends up with this holiday of Purim. But as I said, there are these minor things along the way. There are days of where we come back to life, of resurrection. There are days where the interpersonal, we need to take care of that. So Yom Kippur, we need to forgive one another. On Purim, we need to give gifts to one another. But ultimately, Purim, as strange as this can sound, there are those who say it's a greater holiday than Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur is fixing the bad that we did, and therefore we can't eat, we can't drink, and we're fast, and a day of great holiness. But Purim goes one step further, because Purim says, no, we're going to eat, and we're going to celebrate, and we're going to use the bodies that God gave us. We're going to use our physical selves as much as our spiritual selves, and we're going to try to merge the two together. And that brings me to the very end, which is where we began. All year, all our lives, people drink, and people party, and people do all kinds of things. But Purim is the opportunity of drinking and partying and doing all kinds of things, and turning it into Avodat Hashem, and using it to serve God. Which means, in a sense, we party, we sin, We have complete separation, and that is accomplished by fasting. But then we get to the next level. Now let's serve God through eating right, through drinking, through celebration, through partying, through having a seudah. And that then takes everything and elevates all that we do into service of God. And that's a much higher level even than Yom Kippur, which is just staying away. Yom Kippur fixes the past, but Purim then sets the stage for the future.